CliffCentral.com.
Yebo, it is Monday morning, CliffCentral.com. Bulelo and Leanne and I are here to look after you today. We're going to get into some interesting stuff in just a short while. Valentino Rossi, you mentioned a couple of comments about that. That's coming up in Cliff Central Sport, right?
Yeah. But I mean, he is one of the biggest enigmas, I think, that entertainment. Oh, bless you.
Yeah. So, sorry.
I'm getting a bit emotional about Valentino.
Yeah, because I know all about that. Yeah, I know all about Valentino Rossi. I know nothing about Valentino Rossi, is the answer.
Well, all the oaks in the West Rand, obviously, who love to super car up or whatever, are getting emotional. He's the greatest of all time. I mean, one of the greatest sporting figures of all time. So, I mean, sport, for whether you like it or not, is probably the last sort of appointment television left. And
yeah that's
it's,
true.
It's a big thing for people. It's a big thing for people to lose him, because he was a part of, I guess it was, what I'd say, Gareth, when you left mainstream radio, you know, I'm sure you've had enough letters and emails where people go, hey, you brought me up. I grew up, and I'm sure, Leanne, you've had these letters where people say, hey, I grew up with you. You were there, you know, you were there, and you, or whatever it may have been, my family, car. So Valentino Rossi has
been a part of people's lives.
Billions of people's lives for 20 years. So and an awesome figure, an awesome guy, all-time great. It's definitely a thing.
Leanne has a story about a band, talking about people who you kind of grow up with. And a lot of these bands do crazy things on the stage. I mean, you know, famously, Ozzy Osbourne bit the head off a bat during a live performance. And that was like his thing. I don't know whether that actually happened or not, but it became like urban legend. Well, apparently a band has had to apologize for the singer after she peed in a fan's face during a concert. This is insane. How did this happen?
Well, what?
Yeah. She peed in a fan's face.
When I saw the story, I thought it's probably some band that I don't know, you know, some weird festival, tiny festival that was held. No, it was quite a big thing. It's the band Rage Against the Machine.
What?
Okay. Yeah.
Yes.
So what happened?
So the band has actually had to release a statement after the singer, Sofia Urista.
Yeah.
She instructed a guy, a fan, to come up onto the stage and to lie on the stage floor.
Oh, my God.
She then started peeling down her pants, and she urinated on his face.
Wow.
He was wearing a camera strapped to his head, but she... very good manners of her, kindly encouraged him to remove the camera before the flow commenced.
The flow. Oh, Jesus.
And he seemed quite pleased with the special attention. Well, you know, he was quite happy with it. But this is what happened. So the band sent out a tweet saying, we had a great time last night at Welcome to Rockville. Sophia got carried away. That's not something the rest of us expected. It's not something you'll see again at our shows. Thanks for bringing it last night, Daytona.
Jesus.
So but if the guy liked it, why are they apologizing?
Yeah.
It's still a weird act to do in public.
It's a well-known band.
I mean,
they're not some backwater. They're not some unknown pissy band. This is a serious band, you know.
Yeah, but brings a new meaning to streaming their music.
Yeah,
I don't know. You know, we don't follow these band members from these older bands closely, and who knows what type of changes have gone on in their heads.
Carl says
over the years,
I've heard of the shit hitting the fan, but never the piss. That's impressive. That's very impressive, yeah. The piss hitting the fan, so to speak. Cindile says, it's been a tough weekend for most of us since Ben banned us from touching ourselves. Yeah. Wow. I mean, I would be very upset if I were called up onto, let's say, you know, I was a big fan of, I don't know, Gwen Stefani or whatever, and then she decided to piss on my face. I think it's a little bit disrespectful, even if you're into that in front of a whole lot of people. And I mean, the people who are into that, I don't think they're in the majority. Certainly, it's not something I fantasize about. But if you were into that, would you be into it while everyone else is watching you on a stage? It's kind of humiliating. And plus, did she at least say to him after the show, yeah, you can go wash your face off in my, you know, locker room or whatever, my dressing room.
Again, it's weird because he seemed quite pleased by the whole thing.
Yeah.
But also imagine, I don't think the band knew what was coming.
No.
So imagine how confused they were. And then again in the crowd, people must have been like, is she?
Did she take her pants off?
Is she?
I missed that part. She was naked on top of his face.
Yeah, she stood up. Oh. She pulled on her pants to reveal a completely bare bottom.
Sweet
and
Jesus.
Squatted above his face and just started weeing.
And wow. He just lay there, huh?
Yeah, he was happy with all of this. Again, he had a camera strapped to his forehead. Mm. So I don't know if he was planning on – there's very little context story.
Yeah, now he's got GoPro footage of her hoo-ha as well.
Okay, but it says
she asked him to turn it off.
So I don't understand, because from what I can tell, the lead singer is a guy called Zach De La Rocha, and he's a guy. So I'm trying to figure out who this woman is. Sophia who? Give me her name.
Urista.
Sophia Urista.
Sophia U-R-I-S-T-A.
As in urine. Urinista.
Yes.
Let me just see. Sophia Urinista. It doesn't come. Ooh, okay.
At least R. Kelly did it in the shower. You know, like you say, away from people.
I think this is, there's more to this story. I'm not sure what, and I don't know if I want to dig any deeper, but there seems to be more to this story. I don't know that she's, I don't know who she is. I mean, I don't know Rage Against the Machine, so it might be my own stupidity, but here's what she looks like, apparently. Not a bad looking woman. She's got a little nose piercing there. And she's got like a Latina look to her, if that's not me being racist. I mean, she's very hot. I don't know if I'd want her.
Yeah,
no, she's if I'd want her to do that to me, though. You know, it's a bit of a...
I wonder if there's a threshold for being hot enough to pee on someone's face.
Mm.
I don't know. Wow, what world we live in.
Freedom Fighter says...
What a world we live in.
After the concert, he pissed off. Yes, he did. That's right.
That's good.
Scott says, I saw the video. She pissed like Seabiscuit. Oh, my God. That's a very strong flow. Wow. Sophia Urinista, huh? How's that?
Yeah.
Anyway. Here's a funny thing. Tracy says, have you ever seen a rhino piss? Jeez, it can go on for like 3 to 4 minutes. Oh, that's funny. All right. Enough of that nonsense. That's just unbelievable. All right. So let's talk about this. A waiter, we always wonder about waiters getting really good tips. And, you know, there's some people who don't tip very well at restaurants. I mean, what's the going rate? It's like 10% or something. That should be what you're paying. 10 to 15%.
Yeah.
15 in America, huh?
Yeah. You usually just, in America, you just take the tax and you double it. I think that's how they work it.
And really nice restaurants just put the gratuity in. Like, We're not letting you get no scum here.
Mm. Well, I do think that a tip is something that shouldn't be automatically included. You know, like a tip is what you're giving the waiter or waitress for really great service. It's not part of their salary. They're being paid a salary by the restaurant.
No, a lot of them aren't. When I was a waitress, we didn't get salaries. It was all tips.
Really? That's all you were allowed to take home? Is what the
yeah.
tip? You
mm-hmm.
you got just
exactly.
you got just the tip, Leanne?
Just nothing more than the tip.
You know, I think that we've got to a stage now where I don't know what the right rule is. So I just tip between 10 and 15% anyway, even if it was shitty. And then I just don't go back if it was shitty. So that's my punishment to the restaurant.
No, but if it's shitty, I don't tip. Like a lot of people feel terrible. Like if your service is terrible, I'm not tipping you.
Mm. That's how it should work, right?
Sorry, why am I paying you for me having a terrible time? I paid for this meal.
Right.
A lot of stuff is laid on the shoulders of the server. So many other things could have led up to the service or the food being bad. So I don't think it's fair.
But I don't go to like Spur, right? So when I go to a restaurant, I'm paying a lot for – I save. Like again, I'm not a rich person, but it means so much to me to get to go to a restaurant. I really try and go to nice restaurants. You should be good at your job if you work here. Like, what are we doing? you know? And I will tip. Yeah.
Well,
I will 100% tip.
There's a waiter in Muscle Bay, of all places, who got a tip of 94,486 rand. Yes. Almost 100,000 rand tip.
Yep, that was this weekend.
This weekend.
In Muscle Bay.
Yeah, tell you what. Good places to work.
So it was an American actress and filmmaker, Marcia Kimpton. I looked her up. I don't recognize her.
She's obviously got lots of cash.
But she's not like, you know, A-class celeb. But her and a group of 14 others went to Delfino's restaurant in Muscle Bay.
Okay.
There's a picture of their slip, and it's normal for a bunch of 15 people. Mm-hmm. I, of course, looked straight for all the alcohol because I thought, how drunk were they that they tipped this much? But besides dipping into some Amarilla cream and Amarilla-type drinks, quite a few Jamesons, 7 Jamesons there, a little bit of wine. No, it wasn't enough to make the table, you know, rowdy and mm-hmm. not thinking straight. So the bill came to 3,454 rand. And she made the bill total 97,000 rand 940.
Jesus.
She gave them a 94,000 rand.
It wasn't a mistake.
No.
That's phenomenal. Here's Marcia Kimpton, by the way. That's what she looks like. That's Marcia Kimpton.
No, she's I know. Yeah,
you know
she's
her?
Got Hollywood money. I yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I remember her from films.
Okay. Well, anyway, I mean, so
$1,000.
It wasn't a mistake.
$1,200.
And she decided that she wanted to be generous then, obviously. I mean, this happens. And, you know, it's also a fun story. Like, if you've got serious money and you had a really good time and you feel like the waiter worked really hard to make sure that everybody was happy, it is kind of a nice thing. She gets back to California. She's like, yeah, I gave a $6,000 tip to this kid. You know, nice.
Yeah, that's cool.
Leanne, you're on mute. How embarrassing.
Oh, boy.
The shame.
Before concluding the transaction, the management kept on going over and saying, you know, are you sure? And she said, yes, she confirmed the amount many times. She's in South Africa to film for a new TV miniseries called An American Abroad. Mm-hmm. They went shark cage diving that morning before going to Delfino's. Earlier this year, there was another philanthropist who left a generous tip of 7,000 rand. And I remember that story, and that was also in the Cape. But this was amazing. So the server's name is Zathan McCarthy, and he's decided to share it with his colleagues, which I found really amazing. But there's a great photograph of her with all of the serving staff out on the beach outside the restaurant.
Well, you see, this is why it's also good to work at a really good restaurant that's got a nice view and that the food is really great. Because if you work at a shit restaurant, no one's ever going to tip you that kind of money. No way. And if you happen to be at one of these holiday towns over the December holidays, you may just score a really good tip. Who knows? I think it's great.
No.
But I wouldn't share this with you guys if I were working and you were also.
No.
There's no way you're getting part of my 100,000 rand tip. Sorry.
I was going to ask, how did the story get out? Because they've put him or her in a position now, right?
Oh, God, can you imagine all these people who are going to come running to him now, like, give us some money?
That's what I'm saying. Ugh. I hate that this came out for his sake. I wish it was just like, hey, here's $6,000. You're unbelievable. Don't tell anyone.
Well, the photograph of all of them on the beach together outside the restaurant was from Facebook. So I'm presuming it's either the server or one of the staff or the restaurant itself, which put the photograph up.
Well, Hein says he goes to Delfino's. That's his breakfast posse. Nice, Hein. That's a good place to live then.
You got to tip at least, 5,000 rand?
Yeah, exactly. So Hein, you better start upping the ante there. Otherwise, these waiters are not going to take you seriously. Can you imagine, though, how motivating that is? Like, you're a waiter and you're having a bit of a shit day at work, but you think, let me pull myself together. My problems are not everyone else's. I'm not going to do a bad job just because I'm having a rough time. And then you do a good job of work, and you suddenly realize, like, I just made, like, 94,000 rand on a tip. Like, after that, you work your backside off, man. You never know when the next one's coming. And it could.
Yeah.
It's a pretty rare situation. I mean, it's like lightning doesn't strike twice, but you don't know. Maybe the next time, maybe that woman comes back again and you're like, ka-ching. And then just your luck, she doesn't give you a tip the next time.
Matt Damon married a waitress.
Well,
I don't know if you remember that.
No, I don't.
Yeah, he married a waitress that she served him, and boom, they're married now.
Wow,
Matt Damon. Jason Bourne.
That's quite a tip.
Well, it's different tip.
So, Carla says that you're wrong, Leanne. Rage Against the Machine does not have a female in the band. This is Brass Against, which is a cover band.
Okay. Maybe they're doing a cover.
Yeah,
either way,
maybe they were doing a cover.
I was pretty sure that Rage Against the Machine didn't have a female singer, or even a woman in the band. I think it's like it's an all guy metal band, as far as I knew. But I mean, I'm no expert. So thanks, Carla.
Well, I'm also no expert. And this was just a snippet of a story. So Who knows? You know, maybe I caught the beginning of it and not the end.
Maybe you're just taking
the piss.
But
that's not the headline. That's not the headline. The headline: someone peed on someone's face in public. And let's focus on that.
Yeah. Who cares? Who cares about the band? It's not important. This could be, you know, it could be Debbie Harry for all we care. It's okay. You know. So is it true? Like I'm still stuck on Matt Damon marrying a waitress. That's pretty wild. You know, because we tend to look down on waitresses. I don't, but a lot of people do look down on waiters and waitresses, and they're like, oh, well, they're in. So it's hugely important while you're having that meal. That person's the most important person in your world. So let's not make that mistake. And remember, they're between you and your food. If they don't like you, some pretty terrible things can happen between the kitchen and you. So I always treat waiters and waitresses with respect. I never get cross at them. If I'm unhappy about something, I'm not the kind of person who complains. I know lots of people who do. They go, oh, you know, my steak is underdone or whatever. I just go, it's fine. And then I just don't go back to that restaurant.
Yeah, I'm the same. It's not necessarily the most constructive, but I really hate making a scene. I remember once I was set up on a blind date with someone, and this guy was trying to show off his prowess by demeaning the waiters and being really rude. It was really horrible.
Oh, it's
so
awful.
Embarrassing.
It's awful. I hate it when that happens.
I got taught an interesting relationship with a waiter by my mom once, and she sat the guy down after service, and he'd given us, like, I don't know, whatever. She considered it bad, but she said, hey, listen here, take a seat, all right? I don't see my son often. When I'm here and I have to look for you and my drink's half full, is that you're taking time away from my son. Is I need you to understand why you're not getting a tip. And she sat the guy down. About 3 years later, my mom got an email from the manager of the restaurant. That guy was now the manager of that restaurant. It was quite an interesting story. Yeah. Because my mom is definitely going to sit you down and let you know.
Yeah, but I'm sorry. That's like such a pain in the ass thing to do. Like, this guy doesn't care enough about your relationship with your son. Just, you know, I don't know.
Do your job properly then.
I agree, but don't, you know, really, do you want to be I'm here with my son, time with my son. It's like, that's a bit Karen-ish, if you ask me.
My mom is that person all the time, by the way. If you don't do things properly, she's going to sit you down, and especially if she's paying. Oh, you're going to hear all about it.
See, like Linda says, you do need to complain if you're paying for the food, but call the manager who's paid to deal with that stuff. The waiter didn't cook your food. No, I'm not a complainer, hey? I know it sounds ridiculous because we talk about a lot of shit in this show, but if I'm at a restaurant or a coffee shop or whatever it is and something doesn't turn out perfectly, I just go, well, the universe has decided to punish me today. I'll come to that other place next time. I'll go there instead. I went to the shops over the weekend. I was looking for basil pesto. Okay, I know it's a strange thing to be looking for. I had to go to three different shops before I found it.
Oh, yeah.
But luckily, I found it at the third one because I was going to give up completely on it. No, that's not the end of the world. I would have done something else. But when I eventually found it at the third shop, I was like, well, this shop is going to get my customer, my custom from now on. I'm going to go to them because they have more stuff. They're more organized. There was someone at the, you know, at this deli section or whatever it was, and she was like, can I help you? And I thought, you know what? From now on, I'm not going to go to the first two places anymore. There was no one there who was helpful. They didn't have it. I'm going to go to this shop from now on. It's that kind of decision you make. Just, you know, you don't have to punish people. Just give your service, give your money, to the place that deserves it the most. That's what you should do. Anyway,
yeah,
Elon is God says, I like people who complain in restaurants. I can't do, but watching someone else do it is fun. Yeah. I don't know if I like to watch it. I always feel so uncomfortable when people behave like that in a restaurant. It's just the worst. Annette says, ooh, Ina Parman makes the best buzzard pasta. I didn't know that. I take your word for it, Annette. Thank you very much. I tell waiters that for every screw up or any bad service, I deduct a percentage of the tip. I never have shit service. True story. Yeah, but that's also such an asshole.
No.
That's such an asshole
so
move.
So embarrassing.
You know.
Operating under the gun, huh?
Yeah. You don't need to tell. That's like those people say, I'm going to take off a finger for every £100 you haven't got. You know, come on. Get over it. Horrible. Horrible. There's nothing worse than going to dinner with someone who always has to change what is on the menu, and then they still complain afterwards.
Yes.
That super unfun thing is a deal breaker. Oh, yeah. Listen, I mean, I've got some friends who it's always got to be something that isn't on the menu. It's always got to be done differently. Can we have this, but can you remove that? Can you put some of that in place of this? You can just see the waiter's eyes are rolling in their head, but they're trying to like, okay, sure, of course we can. Yeah, no problem. Assholes.
Can't do it. Can't do it. Yeah. There's two friends, and they both listen to the show. Both of them know. Both female, just so happens in this case.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be caught dead for supper with them.
Famously, Sia Sangweni could never, ever order anything straight off the menu. Everything had to be personalized. Like he was, I don't know, the Dalai Lama. He had to have everything arranged, especially. Can I have this, but would you add just an extra bit of this to it? And, oh no, it's got that in it. No, I can't have that. Let me look again. It's like a 20-minute process to order anything. Anyway. Steph, now suddenly we're onto basil pesto. You see, I knew I shouldn't have mentioned what it was I was looking for. You know, now Steph says, you should try making your own pesto. It's piss easy. But no, I'm not that interested in making my own. They make perfectly good stuff. The professionals can do that. I'll just add it to a pasta and then I'm happy. Thank you very much.
It's really, yeah, it's just to appease those people who are thinking how easy it is. Mm-hmm. It really is. It's basil leaves, mm-hmm. olive oil,
yes.
pine nuts if you can, but they're so expensive now, so you can use something like cashew nuts.
You lost me at leaves.
And,
I've fallen asleep already,
And parmesan cheese, and you just put that in a blender. It's so easy.
Okay. If you live in Cape Town, listen, pesto is a game changer. If you live Atlantic Seaboard, there's a restaurant at the bottom there with a guy in a very Italian name. You know what I'm talking about. They make the best sandwiches in the Atlantic Seaboard. The pesto from there. Oh, I lived in Seapoint for a year. You're joking.
All right. Now, you guys are much more fanatical about this than I am.
Oh.
I mean, I wouldn't know the difference.
Is a game changer.
If it was average or it was great, I actually don't think my taste buds could tell the difference. I'd be like, yeah, that's basil pesto. I have a binary taste system. It's like it, don't like it. Don't want to know what's in it. If it's amazing, I'll be like, wow, that's terrific. But I've never gone, what do you put in that? Ever. Because I wouldn't be able to get home and replicate it anyway. So what's the point? This is not something I spend a minute's time thinking about. I just don't know anything about cooking. I really don't. Mm-hmm. It's the simplest thing in the world. And then people go on about like, oh, but you know, there's this Michelin star chef at this certain place. And I'm like, so what? I mean, it's still just cooking. It's not important. It tastes nice or it tastes shit. If it tasted nice, I could care less whether you're the guy who grills the steaks at Spur or you've got 5 Michelin stars. Not important to me. Jenny says anchovies can be added to a pesto. You see, now we've got all these people coming to the party. So Jenny's now got a recipe. And then LB says, why say basil? Just say pesto.
I don't get that.
I don't know what that is. Like feeding strawberries to pigs. That's me, yeah. You're wasting your time. I mean, so I can still tell the difference between a good and a shit meal, obviously. I mean, I do have taste buds, but they only have on and off. So if it's horrible, it's obviously off. If it's great, it's on. I don't need to know more than that. This is great.
You know what? It's kind of, I know that this is what you're like, and I've come to accept it. Mm. It is kind of, it's sad that you're missing out on, and not by choice, it's just who you are.
Yeah.
But there is a whole range of interesting things that come with being able to pick up different tastes in food. And you know, putting together the recipes and the different cultures and having an interest in it. Ugh. But your interests lie elsewhere. You like statues and history and things.
You'll like this though. I watched Anthony Bourdain, who I know is dead. He died in like 2018 or whatever. But he was an interesting dude. And I watched this documentary on Friday night because I hadn't, you know, I was sitting at home, had nothing else to do. Thought, with this TV thing people keep talking about, maybe I should try that. So I did, and Anthony Bourdain was on in Greece. He was on the island of Naxos, and he was, you know, he eats while he's busy telling the stories, and then he cooks his own stuff, and then he goes to restaurants, he talks to people about, and he had this guy on called Fearless George, who's like a Greek fisherman who has this boat, and Fearless George is, that's a hardcore Greek. He smokes cigarettes while he's busy drinking ouzo, and you know, like eats like Greek salad and all the rest of it, and this guy is busy telling Anthony Bourdain his story. And I found that kind of interesting because it's not about the food. You know, he's doing the food, but that's not the reason for the show. Mm. And so for people who love food, they get what they want, but people like me could watch that show as well. And we would be entertained. Anyway, Fearless George says, all in Greek, and he's got a translator there. He's like, this is my son, Nico. When Nico turned 14, I take him to the brothel. He have sex with whores, and then he's a man. Now he's a man. Now he can work the ship with me. And Nico's like, yeah. This is how they deal with stuff. Yeah, that's like,
my word.
That's what you do in awesome. Greece. Yeah. And Fearless George is just telling the story like it's a matter-of-fact thing. He's not embarrassed. No. This is what Nico is here to learn. He must go to whores. That's where he learns his stuff.
Yeah. That's right? A passage.
No.
Yeah, I love it.
But Gareth, do you know what kind of steak you like? Yes, obviously. But, you know, it's just not the most important priority to me. Like, there's certain things. Like, I was talking to my sister yesterday about the one thing I never like to order from, like, a Mr. Delivery or whatever is salad. I can do, and I like it the way I do it. You know, it's for my taste. I can make a salad. I can do that properly. But it's also the ingredients and kind of that sort of stuff interests me, but only to the extent that once I've eaten it, I forget that I don't talk about it for months afterwards. Like a lot of people go, oh, you know, that burger I had at this place is just life-changing. It's not like that for me. It's different. So anyway, that's enough of that. Now we've ended up speaking about exactly what I didn't want to speak about, which is food. But support the shops that have the stuff that you're looking for is what I basically wanted to get at there.
And leave them huge tips.
Leave an enormous great tip of 94,000 rand. That's the way to do things. All right, so it's time now for Collectomania. This is our favorite part of a Monday where we get to explore people's collections and we get to see what people collect, what their interests and their obsessions are. And it's brought to you by the South African Gold Coin Exchange and the Scoin Shop. You can find out more and you can check them out at scoinshop.com. That's coin with an S at the front of it, shop.com, scoinshop.com. And remember, if you're a collector of anything interesting or unusual and you'd like to tell us about it, then get in touch with us. contact@cliffcentral.com. That's contact@cliffcentral.com. And we could end up featuring you and your collection on Collectomania. This morning, we got Alex Harris with us, and he collects Boer War bullets. This is amazing. So, Alex, first of all, welcome to the show. How are you?
Yeah, morning. Thank you. I'm great today. How are you guys?
Yeah, excellent. It's good to see you, and thank you for joining us. This is a very specific interest. I mean, there are people who collect ammunition, there are people who collect guns, people who collect historical artifacts, but you've combined all of that into a very precise interest in a very particular kind of collection, Boer War bullets. So I can imagine you like roaming around at Isandlwana or Rorkstrift or somewhere in the Free State where one of these big battles between the Boers and the English took place, and like digging around for old shells. Is this what you do?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I have an unusual career. Part of what we do is we host some mountain bike races in really remote places. So over the years, I've had the privilege of being able to just spend an enormous amount of time in these areas, developing relationships with farmers. And that's part of the big challenge is just research, understanding where some of the lesser known battles took place, and then being able to figure out exactly where that is. So, you know, those kind of factors career wise have sort of pointed me towards this, you know, this zeroing in on, but not the Zulu War, so just the Boer War specifically.
Right. This is fascinating. I mean, you do get to maybe be the first person to find exactly where a battle took place. That must get exciting. Do you find yourself going onto Google Earth and like zooming in on a certain little hill and trying to figure out where the people were arranged in their camps or where they actually took each other on in battle? And then you go there and you actually you try to look for evidence. I mean, that's quite fun.
Yeah, I mean, you've pretty much summarized exactly the modus operandi. You know, nowadays, I spend a lot of time with the government 1 in 50,000 topographic maps because that allows us to plot routes and to figure out where to access farms. And so, you know, the kind of journey starts. If I'm trying to zero in on a really obscure battlefield, there might be some maps printed. You know, there was a fair bit of historical coverage, certainly from the British side in terms of archives. Mm-hmm. You know, Amory's collection of books on the official record has many, many maps of battles. So you start off with this really obscure map, and then you get the government 1 in 50,000 maps, and you try and sort of figure out how those two coincide today. Then you've got to go there, you've got to figure out who owns the land, meet the farmer. But at some point, you've got to get out and you've got to obviously walk the hills and see what you find, because what you find speaks far more than what the book wrote about the battle. And that's, for me, the real great interest is what are the sort of artifacts on the battlefield? Mm. How do they describe the events of the battle? And how does that relate to how the officers who recorded the battle, coincide? That's fascinating. I mean, some are accurate, some aren't.
So I mean, I want to know a little bit more about your business and these mountain bike trails that you guys do. But before that, where do you get these maps that you're talking about, these 1 in 50,000? That's an enormous amount of detail. Is that, do you have to ask the government, do they have a website? Is there a thing that you can do there?
You can, so you are able to buy the entire collection on disc, or you can go down to a map studio or Maps for Africa, mm-hmm. and they generally have most of the 1 in 50,000. You know, they're typically available to the public. They're mostly used by, you know, engineers, surveyors, the civil contractors. You know, when they're building a wind farm in a particular part of the country, that's the type of maps they would go to try and figure out some of the earths and go and access, you know, farmers. But they're publicly available. Hmm. They're not that easy to find. But for example, in Johannesburg, there's a map shop about a kilometer from Hyde Park Shopping Center. And they've got pretty much all the 1 in 50s. And as they run out, they just, you know, they top up.
It's amazing. I didn't even know this existed. This is brand new information to me. Now you go to these farms. Have you ever met a farmer who was like, get off my land, I'm not interested, in go and dig around somewhere else? Not happy.
Yeah,
to have
so
you
it's
there.
Interesting. I mean, I've probably been to about 100 battlefields, you know, over the years. And in all that time, I can think of two, maybe three farmers who've said, no, they don't want give you access, or they don't want to allow you to use a metal detector and walk around, you know. Uh-huh. But by and large, 98% of farmers have actually been quite welcoming, and some of them are interested, some of them really aren't, you know. Some of them are sort of third generation farmers on the land, so they have some idea of the history that unfolded. So it's really interesting, you know, to get farmers. But by and large, the vast majority are quite welcoming. Wow. And, you know, sometimes the only way to find, I mean, we've got a, you know, our main mountain bike race is called the Munga. It goes from Bloemfontein through the Karoo to Wellington. It's 1,000 kilometers.
Wow.
We cross about 70 odd farms. Now, some of those are properly remote. And in the early days, you know, the best way to go there is to literally drive onto the land, to just go up to a house that's no longer there, find a farm worker, figure out who owns the land. So it's a long process to piece together. But as you begin to develop a relationship with the one farmer and you start to find some kind of remains of a battle. You then, after a while, ask him to do an intro to his neighbor, and then you phone the neighbor and you build up a relationship with him. And then after a couple of years, you ask for his neighbor. So, you know, over a 10-year period, I'll get to know maybe three or four neighbors and then cover the expanse of a particular area.
It's fascinating, and you must meet such interesting people.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you come across guys who've got, some of the original guns that their grandfather or great-grandfather used that have been passed down, and they've all got stories. They all tell you that, you know, when those guys were attacked, they buried all their guns in that hill, and those guys hid a cache of gold coins. I mean, wow. To be honest, most of the stories are just stories because I've been chasing a lot of rabbits down some holes and not finding stuff. But it is interesting to hear, and some of them have personal stories that have been passed down around how their family experienced the war, which is sometimes quite poignant. And you realize when this current generation of farmers die, those stories are going to be gone. So whenever I get a chance, I encourage these guys, listen, write this down, because it's history and it's important.
The further away in terms of generations we get from these things, the less information is usually conveyed through. And I'm wondering if you've been to over 100 battlefields, you might have even been the first person to see that battlefield or to do any digging around there for 100 years.
Yeah, look, some of the more obscure ones, you know, like our route around the Northern Cape passes through an area where De Wet, who was a famous Boer general, was chased by a whole lot of British soldiers for a couple of weeks. It's really remote. And there, you know, one particular battle, I mean, I know for a fact I'm the only guy. I mean, I've got a good relationship with the two or three farmers around there. And occasionally you pick up what we call surface finds. So a cartridge case that's lying on the surface, it's been lying there for 120 years, and it hasn't been undisturbed, you know. And I'm often there with my kids, and I say to them, look, if we ever see that, don't pick it up. Let's take a photo of it and then pick it up, because it's laying there for 120 years undisturbed. Jeez. And then you're intervening, and you're kind of breaking that that sort of intuitive timeline. So it's a special place out in the middle of the Karoo, in the middle of nowhere. Eh? Mm.
So I mean, when you find these things, do you offer to hand them over to the owner of the land? Is it essentially their property, or are they happy with you taking them to add to your collection?
Yeah, so 99% of the farmers that I've dealt with over the years are quite happy for you to keep the stuff. There's one or two farmers where I've been to regular battlefields or regular times to battlefields, and you know they're interested to see what you find. They found a few things over the years. You know, they've got a sort of a mild interest, but I've never had a farmer say to me, "Look, whatever you find, you need to hand over." You know, and I think it's partly because the life of farming is complicated. You know, most of these guys, you know, don't have the sort of luxury of time to fiddle around with bullets and bombs. You know, bombs. They want to get on. So, I mean, that's also it's a great privilege to be able to develop relationships with these guys, and over the years, piece together what happened. And you know, there's a few so. Just prior, you'll see some of the images I shot a couple of days before the famous Battle of Paardeberg, you know, when Kimberley was relieved. There are a series of battles that happened on the Modder River that are, you know, they're not particularly well known, but they are strategically quite important in how Kimberley was relieved and how Paardeberg would eventually develop. And of course, Cronje lost 4,000 Boers. And, you know, there are many arguments that changed the course of the war. Now, those couple of farmers are quite interested. And, you know, I spend a lot of time looking at some of the old maps of them and trying to piece together where is their farm in this particular map, you know, where was the old drifts. So it's an interesting journey when you get the buy-in from the local guy, and he's particularly keen because he'll have knowledge about his farm that I won't have, or the map won't tell me. You know, the names have changed, the drifts across the rivers no longer exist. So you know that kind of stuff is fascinating.
So let's look at some of these pictures quickly. What do we got going on here? These three cartridge cases that we could see here that are exploded.
Yeah, so that's the what I've just been talking about. So Kimberley was relieved on the 15th of February 1900, and those 2 days before that, these battles were fought. So what happened there was, of course, if we backtrack a couple of months to the famous battle of Magersfontein, mm-hmm. The British column was driving north along the railway line trying to relieve Kimberley, and in a succession of a couple of weeks with those crazy battles like Modder River, culminating in Magersfontein, where the British, they had quite a significant defeat. Now, fast forward a couple of months, the British plan of attack to relieve Kimberley then changes slightly, and they do this move out to the east along the Rit River and eventually the Modder River, and they punch through a set of hills where General French led a charge, and it's really only one of two or three recorded charges, a cavalry charge in the Boer War to push through the Boer lines and then relieve Kimberley that day. The following day, the 16th of February, was the British contingent that remained in that position. So French went to relieve Kimberley, and now there was a strong British group waiting to push Cronje towards Paardeberg along the Modder. Mm-hmm. They had a battle in what's called Klipkraal Drift, but the hills have another name. And so what you see there are 15-pounder projectiles.
Wow.
So the Armstrong breech-loading 15-pounder was the most ubiquitous cannon in the British arsenal. Well,
those are quite big. And those are then quite large. I mean, it's hard to determine scale here. How big are they? I mean,
they're about 18 centimeters when they haven't folded back like that. And Jeez. Inside them are 200 shrapnel balls, and that's a shrapnel shell. So, but what's fascinating about these is I can tell specifically that they were fired by the 82nd Royal Field Artillery Battery on the 16th of February 1900, because it was found in a particular position, and only that battery of the Royal Artillery was engaged. And that's, I mean, it's just, you can get so specific with artillery stuff. You know?
I love this because there's like an investigative, almost like these crime solving shows that you see on TV, but this is a thing that you can figure out. The maps alone, it must take a huge amount of interpretation and work and thinking and moving things around and trying to figure out what's happened. What's going on here? What are these? I mean, I'm surprised you can even tell what those are. They look like just that's the kind of stuff, if you didn't have a metal detector, you'd just walk right past.
Actually, those were all picked up without a metal detector on the surface. Now, I spoke about the third great De Wet hunt, where Plummer was a British general who chased De Wet across the Orange River into the Northern Cape. And this is a year later. So this is in the guerrilla phase. It's 1901. The month is February. And De Wet's intention is to cross the Orange River into the Northern Cape and try and kind of resurrect some of the Northern Cape rebels and commandos. But from the start, it fails. All the rivers are flooded. There is a historical amount of rainfall for those few weeks. And mm-hmm. as De Wet gets across the Orange River in this remote northern part, he realizes it's now a game of survival. And for 2 weeks, he's chased initially by Plummer, but at some point, no less than five British regiments are chasing De Wet. And long story short, he eventually manages to escape back north. But for a couple of days, his Boers are putting up a rear guard. And the one battle is Wolvercale Kopjes, where I've had the privilege of spending years. It's on our route. But 2 days later, De Wet is now moving towards the main railway line between De Aar and Kimberley. And mm-hmm. at a station called Houtkraal, his intention is to blow up the railway line.
Right.
But it's been raining so much that this entire pan floods water into a basin, and the original, the farmers nowadays call it modderflay, for muddy sort of pan.
Yes.
But what happens in this crazy night, and there are not many accounts of this, De Wet talks about it briefly in his book, Three Year War, but in this crazy night, all these wagons get stuck in this mud. And eventually he says to his two RC, listen, I need to go and blow up the railway line. If the British are on your tail, you need to blow up these wagons. And so that's what happens in that dark night. They blow up all their ammunition wagons.
Oh my
in fact,
God.
Some of the British wagons also got stuck in the mud. And so over the 120 years, the remains of these ammunition wagons have lain across this very remote tract of land. And it just so happens that our mountain bike race goes right through this.
Phenomenal.
But so what you're seeing there are actually Martini Henry cartridges. And the Martini Henry is quite a large caliber. It's a 450, so it's almost half an inch, like a close to a 50 cal. Mm-hmm. And they've all exploded, you know. And they were, you know, they're lying on the surface literally just, and they've been lying there for 120 years. But that tells such a story.
That's from them actually blowing up the wagons. So that's not, they weren't fired.
Correct. Yeah. They're not fired. The wagons were set on fire and those cartridges actually exploded.
Are there any remains of those wagons that you've encountered? I mean, apart from the metal, because obviously the metal is going to last a little bit longer than wood. But have you found any other evidence of that night?
You know, I found lots of bolts and interesting these slags. So if you can imagine a whole lot of molten metal, and that's what happened with the lead tips of these bullets
would melt.
I found a few pieces of slag, but in there are still the brass cartridge case and a piece of a. I mean, they're just such an interesting story. The farmers tell me over the years, all the wagon wheels and all of that has been picked up many, many, many moons ago, you know. Hmm. So now it's exceptionally difficult to, you can walk around for an hour and you've got to know exactly where you're walking on this, you know, where this road crosses. And you might pick up one or two blown cartridge cases. So it's, you know, over the years, all of that stuff's just been picked up by the local farmers.
There's such a degree of specificity about what you do here because you really have to know your stuff. What's happening in this picture? What are all those cartridge cases?
So I spoke about the sort of new direction of the British attempt to relieve Kimberley. They were pushed out east, right? And those 15-pounder projectiles you saw were on the 16th of February. And so in the next 2 days, Cronier ended up at Venduti's Drift on the Modder River, and famously bogged down. And that's when the Paardeberg battle then started for the next kind of 10 days. In that period, De Wet encroached on the southern side, and he took over a set of kopjes that are they're known as today on the government maps, they're called Oskopjes. The old farm shows Stinkwaterfontein. In the British maps, they show it as Kitchener's kopjes because the British had possession of those kopjes. De Wet chased them off, occupied the kopjes, and for two or three days held those kopjes overlooking Cronier's lager. And he sent his famous spy, Danny Theron, by himself through the British lines to Cronier and gave Cronier one last way out to extricate him. And Cronier famously declined the opportunity. Danny Theron came back to De Wet and said, look, he's not going to come. And so what you see, those pictures are on the sort of northern fringe of the Oskopjes looking down. They fired by Boers, and they're a combination of Martini Henry. There's some Mausers in there. There's even a number two, a musket number two, the shell on the left at the bottom, which is an old hunting rifle that some of the Boers used in the first few sort of phases of the war. And the cartridge to the right is a Martini Henry, but it's a rolled or soft case Martini Henry, which is exceptionally rare to find in that condition. You can see in the box a lot of the same ones are crushed because they're so soft. And that Martini Henry is the in terms of rolled is the best item I've found. But that was just the last phenomenal opportunity for Cronier to get out of there, and he declined.
Alex, is it rare to find live ammo? I mean, ammo that hasn't been discharged. Obviously, you know that stuff was like hen's teeth, and during the war, any ammo that you could use was used. So people wouldn't just drop a shell and let it lie there. Have you found any live ammo, and what's the procedure there? Because you have to be a little more careful, right?
Yeah, so you have to look. So just interestingly, the British, so the Boers were far more circumspect with their ammunition. They had far less of it, and it's you are less likely to find a live Mauser than you are, or a Martini Henry or something that the Boers used. You know, they also used an 8x60mm Guedes, a Portuguese round. The British, on the other hand, weren't nearly as circumspect, and you find plenty more. I mean, it's a relative thing. It's still rare, but you certainly find a few more. And, you know, it's common knowledge that after the kind of after the initial phase of the war, once Joburg and Pretoria had fallen and we moved into the guerrilla phase, ammunition became scarce amongst the Boers. And so part of their MO to get ammunition was to raid British convoys and to start using 303, you know, the Lee Enfield rifle, and start using British 303. So in the battles in the guerrilla phase, the Boer positions have a mix of ammunition. You'll pick up Mauser, you'll pick up 303, you'll pick up the Guedes, the Martini Henry, and they're all fired by the Boers, you know. You know, you've got to have a license to collect ammunition, so you deal with the live ammunition. You know, it's got to be kept in the safe, obviously, and you deal with the Cartridge Collectors Association, and they put forward a letter of good standing. You know, interestingly, the Mark II 303 is a cordite round, and what would often happen is you call them firelighters, so the British would break off the head and they would bend the cartridge case and they would use it as a firelighter. If ever they needed to start a fire, they would just straighten it, pull out a few strands of cordite and start a fire.
Wow.
So you often find these bent 303s, but if you light that cordite, I mean, it burns today instantly like it did 120 years ago. You know?
Phenomenal. God, I suppose that's
pretty crazy.
One last picture that you have here. What is this? What's going on here?
So those pictures you saw of the 15-pounder projectiles, that's the top of the projectile.
Oh, wow.
And what's screwed on the top there is a number 56 fuse, and that fuse, so before they fired that projectile, one of the sort of the artillery, the battery team, would screw on that fuse, and you might be able to see there's a timer. They could set that timer. It had two rings like a grenade.
Yes.
One ring, if they were going to use the timer, they would pull the ring, set the timer, and then that was designed to blow in the air and scatter those 200 shrapnel balls. The second ring was a percussion. So, in other words, if they were under pressure, and there are a couple of instances, then they would pull both rings, and that meant the bomb, the projectile, would only explode on impact. But that was highly ineffective because none of those shrapnel balls would explode. And that comes from a battlefield just around the corner, Murupeng area, Dwarsfle, where there's a lot of conjecture as to what happened on that battle and, and it's the battle that's closest to my home. So, you know, it's one that I spent a fair bit of time on.
I'm curious also, are there battlefields that have not yet been uncovered or discovered or located? Are there places that you're still looking for?
Yeah, I mean, there are plenty where we know the general position was, but where I have struggled to find any evidence of, and quite a few quite close in the northwest, you know, on the way past Magaliesberg, there's a battlefield called Saferfontein where we host a water point on some of our training rides, and I know the farm as well. We found the original stone that the Imperial Light Horse put up, and that was a battle where Deloray ambushed the Imperial Light Horse in about 10 minutes, shot and killed about 80 horses.
Wow.
And then the British soldiers lay behind their horses in about an hour and a half of furious activity. They had two pom-pom guns, which are these 37-millimeter exploding shells. Two of those came into action, fired 600 rounds. Each of those projectiles explode into one or six pieces. I've never found a single piece of those thousands. So,
wow.
You know, we know the general area, but it's a mystery as to where the action happened. And there are a handful of those places where, I haven't been able to solve the mystery.
So this is really, really extraordinary. I love your collection. I think it's just so great that you are one of the people who's also keeping history alive by, you know, collecting these artifacts and allowing us to determine things that we might not even have known. You're adding to history. But it's fascinating to see also how much evidence there is out there of, you know, what happened just 120 years ago. And it must be really, really exciting for you when you do discover something like this. Thanks for sharing it with us, Alex.
Yeah, no, it's an absolute pleasure. Someone's got to keep the history alive.
I love it. Thank you so much. Alex Harris, our guest this morning in Collectomania. And it's brought to you, of course, by the South African Gold Coin Exchange and the Scoin Shop. You can check them out at scoinshop.com. And remember to message us on contact@cliffcentral.com for a chance to tell us about your collections. Isn't that cool? Imagine going out there with a metal detector or, you know, and you find evidence of these incredible battles that happened. We tend to forget, I mean, even I'm a fan of history and a history student, but we tend to forget how much of this history is right on our doorstep and how much of it just a short while ago was what determined where the borders are, you know, which people won and lost, what it meant to international politics. I mean, that Boer War was something else. And you do find, like, three, 4 generations down the line, there's still this huge animosity and hatred from certain English and certain Afrikaans people towards each other over that war.
Yeah. And it's so interesting how on both sides of my family, going all the way back to my great-grandparents, there were so many cases of an English person marrying an Afrikaans person, the traditionally British person marrying a Boer.
Yeah.
And how much controversy it caused in the family. Yet there was this like undeniable attraction because it was kind of naughty.
Yeah.
It was kind of like warring families in Shakespearean times.
Of course, you move that on a few generations, and the same thing is true for like black and white mixed marriages, you know. It's like it used to be a thing, you know, this is all very controversial and exciting, and you know, a few generations later people are like, yeah, well that's how it goes. That's what everyone's into now. And it's not a big deal to most people. I think it's cool. It's just also really it always fascinates me to hear about these battles and these, you know, we forget that people were shooting at each other and using cannons and artillery fire on what were essentially their fellow countrymen, and now we all live in this country together, and you know, the descendants of those people who actually wanted to kill each other on any given day are now getting along, making things happen.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy to think that there were people, I mean, he talks about De Wet in particular, but running away for weeks on end, being hunted and having to hide in these places in living off of the land.
With no GPS.
No roof over your head. Your wagon's getting stuck in mud, having to blow up your own ammunition. I mean, it's like crazy, man.
Well, Wazi says, in Laudium in Pretoria, my dad mentioned that they would find helmets and ammunition in the veld before the houses were built there.
Wow. Yeah,
that's right. That's right up the road here. Pretty amazing. There's so much more to history when you literally start digging a bit. Fascinating stories from Tracy. Yeah, terrific.
And the fact that he's doing this with his sons as well, I think you mentioned.
That's great. That's so great.
It's so cool. I mean, can you imagine for them going out on an adventure with their dad?
Oh, so much fun. Moonchild says, Alex should start doing SA war history tours. He has such incredible knowledge. Yeah, well, I'm sure he's doing those for the small groups of people that he knows, but that's not a bad idea. All right, that's all we got time for this morning, I'm afraid. We've got to wrap it up for this morning, and we will see you tomorrow at 6 a.m. bright and early. Make sure you are here with us. We are looking forward to sharing the morning with you Tuesday. It's already halfway through November. No, don't panic. Don't panic. Run. We'll see you on Tuesday morning tomorrow. CliffCentral.com